Hi, my name's Michael Earle, and I'm a female alcoholic. And it's nice to be invited back to this conference. It's nice to be invited back anywhere, I guess. But my mind was just racing there, and I don't know why. I just have some stories I never tell, you know, from the podium. And I don't want to tell them. I don't want to tell them. No. But anyway, first of all, I want to apologize for what a flake I've been today. The people on the committee know what I'm talking about. But there was something. Oh, I guess you guys do too. Meet and greet the speakers. Well, I didn't know that we were having that at 5 o'clock. And Carol, I said, check the program and tell me what we're doing. And she called me up and she said, well, in 5 minutes, we're meeting and greeting. I went, oh, my God, I can't. I got to take a shower. I have to take a shower. I mean, I really had to take a shower. This was just pathetic. I'm embarrassed to even share this. Oh, well, what the heck. Well, I just pulled back my sheet, and I noticed in my sheet there was all this stuff. All this stuff. Well, when I went to bed last night, I had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, my time, so it would be 1 o'clock in the morning, your time, in order to get Judy brought me this basket full of goodies, and they had these really good truffles in them. So I thought, well, I'll eat one truffle and go to bed. So I got in bed, and I forgot to eat the truffle. I fell right to sleep. And I rolled around in it all night long. And I don't know how many hours it took me to notice it, because I was pulling back the bedspread or something, and all this junk all over the sheet, all over the pillows, even on the comforter. And I'm going, oh my God, what is that? And then I looked in the mirror, and here I've got it on my arms, I've got it on my back, I've got it all over me. You know, so I had to take a shower. And so I hope it's going to get better after tonight. But anyway, I'm glad I can laugh at it. Things like that used to I was always so terrified. I couldn't laugh at anything. And I'm glad I can laugh at it. My sponsor always says to have fun when you get up here. And I always used to think, is she crazy or what? Because it wasn't fun for me ever to get up here. It's terrifying. One of the most terrifying things I've ever done is have to speak in front of people. And I couldn't even read how it works at a podium with 4 years of sobriety. So the fact that I'm up here laughing tonight about rolling around in my truffles is a good thing. This has been a rough few years for me. I've had a lot of physical problems. I've had several surgeries, back surgeries, and I literally could not sit for a long time. And so I'm really doing well now to even be getting on airplanes, but I do have to have one more back surgery. So I baby myself a little bit, because if I don't, I pay a heavy price, which I'm used to doing, because I don't want to ask somebody to pick something up for me. I don't want to ask somebody for an easier way down the stairs. You know, I just have this pride and ego still. So I pay a lot of prices of being in a lot of pain a lot of the time. But one of my favorite sentences in the big book, it's the bottom of 14, top of 15. It says, for an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive those certain trials and low spots ahead. And that sentence tells me two things. First of all, it tells me if I'm not working with others, I fail to grow spiritually. I can pray, I can meditate, and I can go to church. But if I'm not helping anybody, I'm not growing spiritually. If I'm not helping anybody, I'm no earthly good. And I do believe I'm a spiritual being here having a human experience. And that's what I'm supposed to do, is have a human experience and be of maximum service to God and my fellows. The second part of that sentence tells me if I'm not working with others, I'm not going to survive those certain trials and low spots ahead. So that pretty much guarantees that we're going to have trials and low spots. Even though we're sober, people think you get sober and life gets perfect, and I'm here to tell you that's not true. It gets different. But it doesn't get perfect. And the one thing that gets me through all the trials and low spots is working with others. I could never find words to express what sponsorship really means to me. And it's not about finding the perfect sponsor. It's about being a sponsor. You know, they always did have sponsors, even though the Big Book doesn't tell you to get a sponsor. That's because when they wrote the Big Book, it was a group of alcoholics sober. They hadn't started Alcoholics Anonymous yet. They were still in a religious affiliation. And they wanted this book to work wherever it went. So if it said, get a sponsor, people would just be stuck. They wouldn't know what to do. And so how they got around it is the book teaches you how to sponsor. We have a chapter on sponsorship in the Big Book, and it's called Working with Others. And that's what it's really about. You can't transmit something you haven't got, so you have to do the work first. But I have learned so much more about life and myself through the women I sponsor than I ever did through taking my own inventories. And I just hope all of you find that someday. I know a lot of people find their service work in other areas, like picking up chairs, and thank goodness, so I don't have to do it. And, you know, being a GSO and all that. But still, there's something you're missing if you don't have that sponsorship, being somebody's sponsor and learning and growing with this person. And it's just an experience you must not miss. It's what the Big Book says. You know, it says to watch people recover and to see them help others. This is an experience you must not miss. There's more than that, but I'm just shortening it up. Anyway, so what's gotten me through having all these surgeries and everything is sponsoring in Georgia. I come from California. I met my knight in shining armor in South Carolina. I was speaking at a conference, and this man just swept me off my feet, fairy tale romance. It was just awesome. You know, it was just awesome. I wish I could say the first year was awesome. That falling in love is more awesome. But, and I didn't, you know what happened is I met him, and he lived on one side of the coast. I lived on the other side, on the other coast. And so you don't need to worry about sex or anything like that. So when we got married, I mean, it was like it's supposed to be. I mean, I was actually courted. I was proposed to. I was given an engagement ring. I've never had an engagement ring, and I've been married. This is my fourth time. And we were both pretty old, so we did have a short engagement. And we got married, you know. And then all of a sudden, I'm living with this man that I've never slept with, and it was really different. And I went into menopause, and all I can say is menopause, what an order. My husband just can't go through with it. Thank God for good sponsorship. I would not be married today if I didn't have good sponsorship. Because I hated it there. I just hated it there. The women did not open their arms and embrace me like I think AA women should. They had this, California has a bad reputation, and I don't know why, because I think we're pretty great in California. But a lot of people are afraid when a California person shows up, they're going to try and change their meetings, that they don't work AA the way it should be. And so I was not lovingly embraced, and I had to call my sponsor a lot. And they shoot animals in Georgia. I mean, I'm not in Atlanta. I'm right near the Savannah River, and they shoot animals. I moved there in October, and every truck that drove by me were full of dead deers. I mean, on the hoods, a hood ornament, in the back of the truck. Anything I know about a deer is Bambi, you know, and I love Bambi, and it hurt me to see all those dead deer. And then I was admiring this squirrel that was running up my tree, because I didn't have squirrels where I lived for 45 years. And I'm looking at this darling squirrel climbing up my tree, and he had a pecan in his mouth. The man next door shot my squirrel. He shot my squirrel in my tree. I couldn't believe it, but he said it was his pecan, so he had the right to. So he had the right to shoot my squirrel. But anyway, so I told my husband, I said, well, at least we don't shoot all the animals in Los Angeles. And he said, no, you just shoot each other. Called Polly. I just wanted to come home so bad. I didn't want to be there. And my husband was ready for me to go, too. He thought he married this real together person, and I'm a nutcase. Going through menopause, and I couldn't sleep, and I paced all night like an animal. It was not good. So I called Polly, and I said, Polly, please, can I come home? I just want to come home. And Polly had already met my husband a couple years before I had, so she knew what a wonderful man he was. Incredible. He's the most wonderful man on the face of this planet, I think, except for James and Dave. But I consider them my family, and they're just my favorite guys. But I asked Polly, I said, please, can I come, this and this and this and this and this. And she said, no, you can't come home. You made a commitment to marriage, and you're not 2 years sober or 4 years sober. You know those commitments. I don't know if you've had one of those. I've had one of those. She said, you're 15 years sober, and you work a good program. I know the program you work. So now you're going to really have to put it into place. You're going to have to apply these steps in your marriage. You're going to have to apply these traditions in your marriage. You don't get to come back. And I went, Polly, Ted doesn't want me to stay. He's ready for me to leave too. And she said, I don't care. If Ted wants out of the marriage, let Ted get out of the marriage, but you're staying. And so Ted walked in. I was in a secret conversation with her in the bathroom. Ted walked in the bathroom, and I just said, I'm not leaving this marriage. I'm going to apply the steps in this marriage. I'm going to apply the traditions in this marriage. And if you want out, you have to go. And he looked at me, and he said, but this is my house. Polly, I could hear her laughing on the other end of the phone. It kind of lightened up the whole thing. And we both did, and we started having a meeting in our house on applying the traditions in your relationships. And we had other couples once a month, and it helped a great deal. And the last 11 years have been beyond my wildest dreams. With all the hard stuff that's hard to go through, like surgeries and an ill daughter and those kinds of things, it's still great events. Great events that have come to pass and great events that are still coming. But anyway, my husband's passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous, and he works real hard with others. He used to go to the military base because they have a treatment center there. It's one of the last treatment centers for the military. We no longer have any detoxes or treatment centers for civilians in our area. The government's tired of paying for it. If it turned out sober people, they might still be treating them, but it's not turning out sober people. They go in and they go out, and they go in and they go out. And so anyway, he would take a newcomer meeting over there, just trying to get them acquainted with what AA was about, because what they get is good, but it's not Alcoholics Anonymous. It's therapy. And I'm glad about that, because I get a little resentment when I find out some center is making money on the 12 steps. I think that's fine. You stick to that, and we'll stick to this. But anyway, we got really close to all the counselors up there, and they finally gave us permission to have them over to our house. Every Wednesday night, we'd go pick up these soldiers, bring them over. We'd have a barbecue so they could see that, that there's fun and sobriety, and we would have a lot of fun, because we have some really crazy old-timers there that just have you laughing all the time. And then we'd go into what I call my AA room and get into the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So the goal was, we would have a short overall view of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, what I call the God Shots. And then we do step one out of the Big Book, step two, step three, have them on their knees saying the third step prayer. And when they leave, praying that they get a sponsor. And a lot of the time, because I travel so much, I can hook them up with somebody. But This is something that I believe has kept me sober during the trials and low spots, are these soldiers. We always have people living with us, always. Been married 12 years now, and we have from 1 to 6 people living with us. And when you have 6 newcomers living with you, your life is really unmanageable. There's no manageability there. So we're keeping it down to 1 or 2. And the last few, and the 2 that are there right now, we're both in the military. And they're just wonderful, wonderful human beings. I just feel like it's a privilege to get to work with them. But I had just had this surgery, this back surgery, and they send you home right away. And it was Wednesday morning, and I woke up, and I told Ted, I don't think I can meet with the soldiers. I'm in too much pain. I was running a fever. I had blood loss. And his job is to get the food ready and listen to their inventories and teach them how to balance a checkbook and get their license back. He teaches them how to live, and I get them through the book. But so we make a great team. Anyway, so as the day went, I just kept hearing my sponsor's voice saying, you can be sick in a meeting as well as you can be sick in bed. Sick is sick, so you might as well plant that butt in a meeting. And this was surgery. My back's cut open, so I knew she'd be okay with that. But I just kept hearing that all through the day, so I decided I was just going to meet with the soldiers. I mean, I didn't have to go anywhere, just go in the other room. So met with the soldiers, and there were about 35 people there, and we were on step 2. And this gentleman, he was sitting right here, his name was Lee, just stood up, and he's towering over me, and he screamed at me, if there's a God, it's going to take a burning bush to prove it to me. And my first thought was, I can't believe I got out of bed for this crap. I just started admitting that. Then I had a spiritual thought, like, God help, you know. His name was Lee, so it reminded me of another man named Lee that had a spiritual experience during one of my AA talks. Had nothing to do with me. It had everything to do with him and his higher power. If you heard the story, you'd understand. I'll try not to tell it because it takes so much time. But what brought about the spiritual experience for the man that had it during one of my talks is I always close my story with how I came to this. Is I don't like the room set up this way because you're, you know, not knowing who to talk to, making me dizzy. I'm sorry. I make amends promptly when I I'm very sorry. Anyway, I closed my story with how I came to terms with the God I have in my life today, and that was through a tragedy that I had in my life. My daughter was 3 years sober. I was 4 years sober. She was leaving an AA dance. In the parking lot of the dance, a man came up to her with the gun, and her girlfriend was with her, and he kidnapped these 2 girls, knocked the one girl totally unconscious, and brutally raped my daughter for over 2 hours. And rape is really about terror, and it's about violence. It's not about sex. And it just was one of the most devastating thing that could have happened. And my daughter lost her sobriety over it, and she didn't want anything to do with the word God. And I managed to stay sober, but everything I knew about God had changed. So I had to seek God at a different level, and I had to seek and seek and seek. And I've had many little spiritual experiences that worked up to one big spiritual experience. And the only thing I can tell you that I know for sure for me about God today and for years now is that God is good and good is God. And if it's not good, it's not of God. There is a difference between man's world and God's world, and that kidnap happened in man's world. So when I was saying the words, God is good, good is God, that brought about that spiritual experience for the gentleman listening to my story. And I'm still telling this man, namely, my story. I'm looking to see if you have any bushes here. Well, we had 2 bushes on both sides of our couches, and we have to move everything apart because to squeeze in chairs to get all these guys in the room. So this is the honest to God truth. This one bush was shoved against in the corner against a halogen lamp. And you know how halogen lamps are pretty flammable. I'm saying the words, God is good and good is God. And honest to God, the halogen lamp caught on fire and the bush caught on fire. Poof. So I've got this fire. I mean, my house is on fire. I'm not even thinking about his burning bush thing. I forgot about that. My house is on fire and I am just freaking out. And I'm screaming at the soldiers, do something, do something. And they got into action pretty fast, and they got the fire out, and they got the lamp out and took them outside and cleared away a lot of the smoke. And then we, after the chaos, we all sat down again, and that's when I got it. I didn't get it until the fire was out. I sat down there, and then I just remember that feeling of, oh, my God. He demanded a burning bush, and God delivered it. And you could feel the energy go around the room. It just went around the room. All of us got it at the same time. And the whole point of the story is I could have missed out on that. There's not a drug you can put in your body, not a chemical you can put in your body that feels like a spiritual experience or watching another person have a spiritual experience. And when you watch another person have a spiritual experience, you share in that experience. And it's part of yours. And I could have missed that if I had stayed in bed and not met with those soldiers. And those soldiers, they were so transformed. It was just a beautiful thing. They went back to the treatment center. Now the treatment center is really impressed with AA. And so now they're busing them over to our house. We used to have to go pick them up. Now they come on this big white, it looks like a prison bus that you see on the highway with the prisoners getting out and picking up trash. I mean, the bus looks just like that, and it comes down. We live on a little cul-de-sac, and it comes down. It goes all the way around the cul-de-sac, comes up, and then stops in front of our house, and all these guys get out, and they don't have uniforms on, so they look like hoodlums, you know, and so this has been going on for a lot of years now, this bus bringing these soldiers every Wednesday night, and it's a loud bus, and not once has any of the neighbors had the courage to ask me what's going on. Not once has anybody asked me what's going on. We have trivial conversations and that kind of stuff, but nobody's ever asked me, hey, what goes on in your house on Wednesday night? So if any of you are ever out in my area of Georgia, please on Wednesday night come and meet the soldiers because they are pretty awesome. They are just pretty awesome. And I just love them to pieces. When they started going to Iraq, does anybody have a big book? Nope. When they started going to Iraq, it was really difficult because I'd have guys 21 days sober and 28 days sober being shipped off to Iraq. And I just started giving them a mini copy of the big book that they could carry in their pocket above their heart. And I highlighted 102 where it talks about, packing into the mainstream of life, staying on the firing line of life, and talking about God will keep you unharmed, and highlight that for them. A lot of them have kept in touch with me. A lot of them haven't. So, oh, that's good. Oh, great, a big book. So now I can tell you what it really says. I got the page right, 102. But I just love this paragraph because it gives me courage to get on airplanes. It gives me courage to have a surgery. Anytime I'm full of fear, I turn to this page. And it just still gives me courage. And it's in the first 164 pages of the big book, and it says, your job now is to be at a place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. Keep on the firing line of life with these motives, and God will keep you unharmed. And one of our soldiers, this is one story that I don't normally tell either, one of them who had almost 20 years was kicked out of the ESAP program, treatment center, and then kicked out of the military. He was angry man. But he hung with us in AA, three of us, that we used to take walks in the mornings. And I got to watch him have a spiritual experience, and I got to watch him change. And he ended up taking a civilian job that took him to Iraq. So now he's working Iraq, and he hooked up with an old Navy SEAL guy, and they started Alcoholics Anonymous in Iraq. Now, this has been a couple years now. And they had the most beautiful chip printed out that says, it says Serenity in the Sand, and it has a picture of a camel. And on the other side, it says, in accordance with the seventh tradition, which means that they're registered in New York. And it says the very first meeting in Iraq. And when they presented that coin to me, I can't tell you what it means, and I can't wait for the next international, because I just know that Iraqi flag's going to be on that stage with all the other flags, and I'm going to be just cheering them on and probably pretty hysterical. I just think it's so awesome. Now there's three or four meetings that, you know, there's quite a few. All the different nationalities that are over in Iraq attend them, and the Iraqis attend them, and they do have alcohol in Iraq. It's not like Kuwait. Boy, I really got off on that one, huh? I had a whole different other story I was going to tell you, but anyway, when I crawled through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous almost 28 years ago, God, that's so hard to believe. Almost 28 years ago. Thank you. I mean, I can remember just recently having this thought many times, is how did I get to be 60? I mean, 60. I've had a lot of surgeries and I've had a lot of problems, but I don't feel 60. To me, 60 old, you know. I'm 60. And I just can't get over it. But that's the problem with getting a lot of years of sobriety. You also get chronologically older. But anyway, when I crawled through the doors, I had a formal ninth grade education. I didn't know how to work. I lived on welfare. I was reduced to prostitution, and I was a thief. I always swore I was never going to be an alcoholic like my mom. That was my main goal. When I grow up, not to be a nurse, not to be a lawyer, when I grow up, I'm not going to be an alcoholic like my mom. You know, my mom and I both tried to recover from this disease through the psychiatric effort. Different times, but we went to the same psychiatrist. Of course, the result was nil. But the good news is that today that same psychiatrist is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom and I both tried to recover from this disease through the religious effort, different times in different congregations, and believe it or not, today that minister that counseled me is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to joke around and say, I think we drove these two men to drink. But the truth is, and this is the truth, my mom slept with the psychiatrist and I slept with the minister. I can just remember my sponsor saying, my dear, that's not exactly AA's idea of a spiritual experience. So James is going to be our Sunday morning spiritual speaker. Can you top that? Anyway, I want to share a little bit with you about my background. First of all, I'm Irish, German, and Cherokee, and I'm illegitimate, and being born out of wedlock today is not a big deal. But when I was a little girl, it was, and my childhood is pretty appalling. So in my mom's defense, I want to tell you a little bit about her childhood, because as bad as mine was, my mom's was worse. And this program gave me the ability to have a very loving relationship with my mom, even though she couldn't quit drinking. I lost my mom about 15 years ago. She died of lung cancer. And I had the opportunity to practice love and service at home. My sister and I took her home. We had hospice come in, and my mom actually got to die with a little bit of dignity. And I had to watch her drink on top of morphine up until the day she could no longer swallow. And it's probably one of the hardest things that I've ever done. But, I mean, I can remember I could get in bed and hold my mom all night and just love her unconditionally. And that's what I got from you guys, the ability to love my mom unconditionally. This whole experience, what I learned from this whole experience is that my whole life growing up, I was so focused on the things I hated about my mom, the things I didn't want to be like, that I missed all of her wonderful qualities. My mom had a lot of wonderful qualities, and I really miss her a lot today. But my mom came from an alcoholic background, and when she was 13, her mother was murdered in a drunken brawl. A drunk slit my grandmother's throat. And her dad was on a chain gang in Colorado, and so my mom was forced to live out on the streets trying to take care of herself at the age of 13. At the age of 14, she had her first baby, which she gave up for adoption. And then she had me. She did everything in her power to keep me. She later met this man, got married, had three boys. We all moved to California. That marriage soon ended in divorce, and my stepfather moved back to Colorado. So that left my mom out in California trying to raise four little kids. And we were raised on welfare. We were raised in extreme, extreme poverty, always having lights, gas, telephones turned off, always being evicted, even having to sleep in cars. And then I had to deal with my mom's alcoholism, I had to deal with her prostitution, and I had to deal with her suicide attempts. When I was 12, my mom got pregnant again. And this time she sent my three younger brothers to live with their real dad in Colorado. Now, my three brothers were my best friends. When you're sleeping in cars, you don't really have an opportunity to make friends. So my brothers were my friends. So I feel like at the age of 12, I already had all these feelings that I later brought with me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And those feelings were of low self-worth, low self-esteem, not equal to, and just not good enough. And that was a direct result of all that poverty. The drunken psychiatrist pointed out to me that I had issues of abandonment. You know, I never knew my real dad, my stepdad went away, my three brothers went away, my mom's always trying to kill herself, and because of some other childhood experiences, I would say I'm a fear-based person. I have always been afraid of people, places, and things. And the two very important things I learned when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, first, I learned that feelings are not facts, and all those things I used to think about myself are not the truth. And best of all, I learned how to walk through fear. And I learned that every time I walk through fear, I'm actually exercising faith. And this last 13 or 15 years, I'm losing track, I've walked through one of my biggest fears, and it's getting on airplanes. I'm just absolutely terrified of flying. And I found out I'm really not afraid of flying. I'm afraid of crashing. My sponsor said I'd better be clear on what my fear was when I was asking God to remove it. But I hear things in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that are not in the big book. And sometimes they can confuse a newcomer. And I'm a person that quotes pages, and it's not to impress you that I know these pages or anything. When I quote things out of the big book, I want you to know that's in the book. You can find it, and you can take it to the bank. Anything else I say is my opinion. And we all have opinions, but, you know, my opinions might not work for you. They just work for me. So that's why I want to be clear of what's in the book and what's not in the book. But the one thing I used to hear all the time is that you could not have fear and faith at the same time. That if you had fear, you didn't have any faith. And I couldn't figure out what I was doing wrong in my program, because I had worked these steps as hard as I could work these steps. And I've had spiritual experiences, but I still had all this fear. And I finally went up to one of these men that was always making the statement, and he always passed out a coin that said faith on one side, fear on the other side. And anyway, I said, what am I doing wrong in my program? Why do I still have all this fear? And he told me in the most smug way, he said, well, it sounds to me like you haven't taken a thorough third step. Well, today I know I had taken a thorough third step. To the best of my ability, I continue taking a thorough third step. I mean, for me, the third step is a process. It's not just getting on your knees and saying a prayer. It's a process. I mean, if you really think what it means to turn your will and your life over to the care of God, it's not something you just do like that, you know. And I found for me, the process started when I started on step four. Taking the actions of 4 through 9 started the process of my really turning my will and my life over to the care of God. And how I continue on a daily basis doing that is I live in 10, 11, and 12. But anyway, I went up to another old-timer who was really instrumental in my sobriety, and I was crying on his shoulder. I was tattletelling on this other guy. He said that I didn't work it through a third step. And his name is Bill Honeycutt, and I say his name because he would say, he always said his last name. In fact, there were two Honeycutts, Frank and Bill Honeycutt. They were brothers. And Frank just recently died. Bill died in 1987. But anyway, so I went up to Bill, and I'm crying on his shoulder about this fear and faith thing. And he said, Michael, nowhere in the big book does it tell you you cannot have fear and faith at the same time. And he took me to the big book. He took me to page 68, and it's under the fear inventory. And what it says about fear, it says, all men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. And then he pointed out to me, you don't need courage unless you're afraid. And then he took me down to the bottom of that paragraph, and it gives you that little fear prayer. God, remove my fear and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. And I'm always directed to work with another person, whether they're in the program or out of the program. If I can help somebody else, that takes me right out of that fear. And that's how I used to get on airplanes when I was so terrified. You know, that first flight I had to take, someone was going to walk me up to the plane and kick me on it, and she couldn't. She had to drop me off at LAX, and I collapsed in a chair, full-on panic attack where my legs wouldn't hold me up. And I just finally started crying because I knew I wasn't going to get on that plane. I knew that fear was going to keep me from getting on that plane. And I had that inner voice that I've had several times, and it just, I call it God. I don't know what other people call it, but I call it God. And it wasn't real tender and loving at that one. So I'm collapsed in this chair and I'm crying, and I just hear this voice, and it goes, Michael, why don't you just get out of yourself and try and help somebody? So I ran around the airport trying to help little old ladies that were struggling with their bags. You know, back then you could do that. And, you know, there's an escalator that goes up, so I could always help a little old lady up the escalator or help them on the plane, or if they were trying to get to another concourse, because I'd always get there early. That's how I'd get on planes. It's so funny. This time at the airport, I was that little old lady that other people were helping. I couldn't believe it. These bags were so heavy. And the first plane, you have to walk up these stairs, and there's all these military guys back there. And I took a step, and I fell, and the guys caught me, and two guys carried my bags up, and then a woman helped me off the plane, and somebody got me a wheelchair, and I'm going, oh, my God, I'm that old lady I'm helping. Oh, no. But that was a very humbling experience, to humble myself to let somebody get me a wheelchair. Oh, my God. But I don't think I'd be standing up here right now if I hadn't have humbled myself. And I really didn't have a choice. People just took over. The last sentence in that paragraph says, at once we commenced to outgrow fear. It doesn't say at once we outgrow fear. It says we commenced to outgrow fear. And I can tell you today, I'm almost 28 years sober, and I'm still commencing. And that's okay, because that's covered in the big book. It's covered under steps 10 and 11. In step 10, it says we're to continue watching for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. It says it's not an overnight matter, that it should continue for a lifetime. And then under the 11th step, we have a paragraph that reiterates everything I just said. They're commingled in the big book. And it's on retiring at night, and it asks seven questions. And that's how I do my 10th step, even though it's under the 11th step. I answer those questions. And I do my 10th step in writing because I did my 4th step in writing. There's something a little different looking at it in black and white than just rolling it around in your brain. And so I answer those questions. And the very first question says, were you dishonest, resentful, selfish, or afraid? It says, do you owe an apology? Have you kept something to yourself that you should share with another person? The most powerful sentence, question that it asks, for me, it's been a tool to change my behavior. It says, what could you have done better? And writing on a situation that did not go well that day and looking at how I could have done something that might have made it better has helped me change. That has helped me with the psychic change. It really has. And then it asks you to look at the good things. You know, were you packing into the mainstream of life? Were you kind and loving towards all? It's constructive inventory, not destructive. So you look for the good and the bad. So that's been most helpful for me, and I still do that today. The next paragraph on that page says on awakening, and it talks about prayer and meditation. And so in the morning is where I do my formal prayer and meditation on awakening. And then, of course, I pray all through the day because I'm real sick. And I really need a lot of help. So I pray all through the day. That's not a problem. So anyway, when I was 13, my mom did have this baby. And I had to learn how to be a mom, and I didn't even know how to be a kid. My mom's alcoholism took her out of the home. She was never, ever around. I had full responsibility of this baby. This little baby is sleeping in a dresser drawer. I eventually had to potty breaker, bottle trainer. I mean, bottle breaker or potty trainer? Yes, bottle breaker and potty trainer. I'm failing in school because I can't get to school because of this responsibility. Now, the truth is, after doing my inventory, I found out that I hated school anyway. You know, when I went to school, I was either an object of pity around my peers or I was teased about the way I dressed and teased about my hair. And so specifically to get out of my home life at the age of 15, I got married. And the man I married lived in the neighborhood. He came from the same kind of background. He was 18. I have such a colorful past that I like to brag about this. I want everybody here to know when I got married at the age of 15, I was not pregnant. At the age of 15, I had high morals and high values. I truly did. I used to watch these TV shows. They were my favorite programs. Very unrealistic, but to me, they were, you know, like how a family should be. And it was Donna Reed and Father Knows Best. And, you know, Donna Reed, gosh, she vacuums in this beautiful dress with all these petticoats under it and 4-inch heels, you know, and she's just vacuuming. And so that's what I thought families were supposed to be like. So when I got married at the age of 15, I had this wild idea. I was Miss Donna Reed, married Mr. Father Knows Best. And unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way. And I believe the man I married was an alcoholic. One indication, his name was Johnny Walker. Should have had a clue. I want to share a story with you about that sister of mine, the one that slept in the dresser drawer. Because when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to blame my alcoholism on my mom's alcoholism. And I blamed the way I acted on the way I was raised. Everything was about my mom's fault. I'm having one of those little senior moments. Senior moment. Anyway, I blamed everything on the way I was raised and on my mom's alcoholism. I took no responsibility. I was not accountable. After I got to this program, I took a good look at that sister of mine because she came from the very same background. In fact, I would say her childhood was worse than mine because my mom's disease had progressed. And my sister was literally forced to move out of the house at the age of 16. She quit school and she moved out. But what she did is she took that high school equivalency test and she had to take it 3 times until she passed it. And with this test under her belt, under a special youth program, she went to work for the city of Long Beach at the age of 16. At the age of 26, she retired from the city of Long Beach. She took her retirement money, 10 years of retirement money, and she bought her own business. She later married the head traffic engineer of the city of Long Beach, and I guess it's been 10 or 15 years ago, at the age of 30, my sister was awarded Woman Entrepreneur of the Year. Now, even today, sometimes I still don't get it. You know, same mom, same background, but different reactions. And the difference is my sister's not an alcoholic. My sister is not bodily and mentally different from her fellows. My sister reacts to life situations differently than I do. So today I get to accept responsibility. and I can no longer blame all those people, places, and things. I am an alcoholic, and I do have a disease, but today I have a solution. And for me, part of my solution is being accountable for my actions, my past actions, and my present actions. So at the age of 15, I got married. At the age of 17, I did have a baby. At the age of 18, I had to get out of this marriage because this man took me through a whole new phase of alcoholism I never experienced with my mom, and it's called physical abuse. And he never abused me unless he was drinking, but he abused me to the point of cutting me up with a knife, and I had to have surgery to repair the damage. So I got out of that marriage at the age of 18, and I feel like that's when I started on the road of being everything I swore I'd never be, doing everything I swore I'd never do. Hadn't even taken a drink of alcohol yet. I always intuitively knew if I took a drink, I'd be an alcoholic. But it started out with me being a single mother living on welfare. Growing up like that, I swore when I grew up I was not going to live like that, and there I was. Now, on page 23 in the big book, it says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. So we're talking about the main problem being the mental obsession and not the physical allergy. So I know for me, I practiced my disease of alcoholism way before I ever took that first drink, because I've always had the mental obsession part of this disease. I practiced it in the form of compulsive overeating. I would shove food in my mouth instead of alcohol. And then I discovered that wonderful world of diet pills. And that's back in the days when doctors gave you really good methadrine, dexedrine. It's all illegal today. So I went on this diet for 16 years. When I finally took that drink at the age of 25, I immediately had the physical allergy. From that very first drink, I had the phenomena of craving. From that very first drink, I had a personality change. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you read about that in the big book. The big book refers to that as a real alcoholic. I personally am so physically allergic to alcohol. When I consume alcohol, I break out in a rash, welts, and hives all over my body. And I was always too drunk to have a clue that that wasn't normal. And if I'd had a clue, it wouldn't have made a difference. But from that very first drink, I drank morning, noon, and night. I did not draw a sober breath from the age of 25 to the age of 31. And that's not an exaggeration. I had a huge spiritual experience way before I ever got to this program. It was equivalent to the one that Bill had in Bill's story. In the big book, it says, as a result of a spiritual awakening, you'll have a change in attitude. It says you'll have this huge emotional displacement and rearrangement. And this spiritual experience I had was not enough for me to achieve that. And I believe it's because I did not have a plan of action to go with it. But it was enough for me to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. So what I did with this experience is I sought out a specific church. And I counseled with the minister, and I told him all about my spiritual experience. I shared with him all my character defects, all my shortcomings. And this man assured me if I got really active in this church, and I read all these inspirational books, and I did all this positive thinking and affirmations, that I could be everything that I ever wanted to be. After I got to this program, I heard a speaker at the podium say, if you're alcoholic, you cannot think your way into right actions. He says, if you're alcoholic, you have to act your way into right thinking. And I'm absolute proof of that because I got really active in that church. I even became the secretary of that church. I struggled reading those books because I could hardly read. I did all that positive thinking, constant affirmations. And the only thing that resulted is I ended up having a torrid affair with this minister, and it absolutely infuriated his wife. Which in turn infuriated the whole congregation. So I'm kicked out of a church. After I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I started working those 12 steps, I found for me the most important step, besides step 12, was step 9. Step 9 is the amend step, the step where we make restitution, and I recommend you do the first 8 steps before you get to step 9. I know some people come into this program, they took a look at step 9, it's so scary, they turn around and they leave. Other people come in and start right in on step 9 and make very inappropriate amends. And I believe the steps are in order for a reason, and I believe this one in particular should be taken with the advice of a sponsor. And it's not a coincidence that in the Big Book those promises come after step 9. It says before you're halfway through, you'll know a new freedom and a new happiness. It says you won't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, and so on and so on. And I did not have to wait to get halfway through step 9, thank God, because it took me 12 years to complete step 9. That happened to me with my very friends, and that was going back to that church and telling that minister I used to steal from the church funds. And I set up a payment schedule to pay back the church. He knew, he told me he knew that I was stealing the money the whole time. And I said, well, did you know I took money out of your wallet when you were in the shower? No, he did not know that. So I had to make restitution to him too. But the neat thing about this experience is he shared with me at that time, by the time I got to him, he had 2 years of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When he lost his, oh, I never even told you about. Oh, no, I didn't tell him about that. I didn't tell him about the one-legged minister. Oh, I better tell you this because it's just, I better tell you. You know, and when I got to this program, I was incapable of laughing. And I used to hear that laughter was healing. And I'd be in a meeting this size. This is the size of our home group. And speakers in California are theatrical. They get up here and everybody laughs, you know. And I was incapable of laughing. I just could not laugh. And then after I had about 2 years of sobriety under my belt, I caught myself in the back of the room laughing too. But right after having this huge belly laugh, I found myself thinking, well, that might be funny for you, but there is nothing, absolutely nothing in my background I could ever laugh at. And then it was about, I don't know, 15 years ago. It was just my second time to ever give an AA talk 13 years ago. It was my second time to give an AA talk. The first one was, I guess it was okay. I got invited to other places to speak, but it was just the most depressing. I was so sad after that. I mean, I could have committed suicide. It was just a really sad story. I went to bed that night, and I said, because my sponsor always was trying to push me into talking. I went to bed that night, and I said, okay, God, if you want me to do this in AA, you're going to have to lighten up my story, or I'm going to kill myself. And so the next time I talked, it was at my home group in Seal Beach, and my daughter was trying to get sober again. You know, she was in and out with the God thing. And this was towards the end of her drinking. But she heard I was talking, and so she wanted to come hear me. And before the meeting, she brought over some of her program girlfriends, and we sat down, we had coffee, and then she proceeded to tell her girlfriends my drunk log. And for some reason, it was a little funnier coming out of her mouth than out of my head, you know. I just never thought about how some things look through the eyes of a little 9-year-old, and because she was 9 years old when I was seeing this minister. And anyway... She comes home from 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She opens the bedroom door, and there, naked in bed with her mom, was the married minister of the church. And I just looked at my daughter, and I mean, I felt this shame, guilt, embarrassment, and I just felt pain for my daughter. And I just looked at my daughter in the most sympathetic way. I said, God, honey, that had to be a terrible shock. And she just looked at me and she said, no, Mom, I don't know what shocked me the most, seeing that minister naked or seeing his artificial leg on the floor. So, yeah, that's my spiritual experience. One-legged minister. So... Anyway, when he lost his leg in that motorcycle accident, he was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and he actually died on the operating table. He had one of those near-death experiences, which for him was his spiritual experience. And that's what led him into ministerial school and becoming a minister. And even he could not get sober in church. And I'm not putting down churches, and I'm not putting down the psychiatric effort, because the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous makes it real clear that this program owes a lot to both of these institutions. And in the Big Book, it says if you need professional help, do not hesitate to seek it. But But I have to tell you, it was all about that miracle that happens for me. It was all about that miracle that happens when one drunk reaches out to another drunk. So I've been kicked out of this church, obviously. I'm living in an apartment I'm being evicted from. Lights and gas had been turned off for a while, and I got a telephone call, and I could not believe the man on the other end of this phone. It was 11 o'clock at night. That's why I had the phone. It was a working priority. And the man on the other end of this phone was my real dad. I mean, it was my real dad. I couldn't believe it. And he wanted to make amends for not being in my life. He wanted to get to know me, and he wanted to get to know my daughter. So he offered me an opportunity to move to Colorado to get to know him and his whole family. And I did not want to go. I didn't have any desire to get to know him. But mostly I didn't want to move to the snow. But at that point in my life, I had nowhere to go except for out on the streets. And deep down inside, I did have a little hope that if I did this geographic, maybe I could change. So I made that move to Colorado, and I lived there for 3 months. And in this three-month period, this man and his family could not wait to kick me out of the state of Colorado. In that three-month period, I ended up having affairs with the bus drivers on the way over there, getting pregnant, having an abortion, falling down the stairs, breaking my leg, ripping off his medicine cabinet, ripping off his booze cabinet, ripping off his money. So they literally kicked me out of the state of Colorado. I'm going to tell you how I broke that leg. Obviously, I was drunk. And where I lived, the liquor stores closed at 12, didn't have a car, so I had to walk. And we had had ice storms, and it was very cold and yucky outside. And I'm walking down the stairs, because I lived in a second-floor apartment. I'm walking down the stairs that are very icy. I'm hanging onto the railing with my right hand. My daughter's on the left side of me trying to hold me up. And I looked up at another second-floor apartment, because it was right in front of me, and the door just opened, and out of that door walked a priest. I don't know what he was doing there, but he had the collar, you know, that kind of priest, the collar, the robe, everything. He's definitely a man of God, and I am very angry at God. In my alcoholic thinking, I'm angry at God. So I looked up at that priest, I let go of the railing with my right hand, I flipped up my middle finger, and I screamed, "F you, God!" And I immediately fell down the stairs and broke my leg. My daughter told me that is the day she started believing in a punishing God. Today we know I fell because I was drunk. It had nothing to do with God. But my real dad was second on my list of amends to make when I started making my amends. And I wrote this man a letter, and I told him I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to make restitution for my behavior up there. And I sent him a check trying to set up a payment schedule. I could never pay anything off. I worked paycheck to paycheck and worked on paying my amends in payment plans. That's what I had to do. And so I sent him a check trying to set up a payment schedule and wanting to make restitution. And basically what he and the family did is they sent me the check back with a little note that didn't want my money, and they never wanted to hear from me again. I was working with a sponsor, so of course I stayed sober. But I still really did want to make these amends. I don't know why. You would have thought I knew him my whole life, and I didn't. But I really wanted to make these amends. And, well, not did I want to make him, I wanted him to accept him. But anyway, so with my sponsor's encouragement on just taking the actions of being a good daughter, on every Father's Day and on every birthday, I would send him an appropriate card. I would tell him I'm still sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still want to make restitution for my behavior up there. And I did this for 5 or 6 years, maybe 7 years, I don't know. And I would never hear from him. He never replied. And finally, in 1985 or 1986, I sent off another card. And I, same spiel, I'm still sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still want to make restitution for my behavior up there. And this time, I got a reply back. And when I saw the return address on that envelope, I cannot tell you the joy I felt. And I ripped open that envelope, and the only thing that was in it was a picture of his tombstone and the obituary out of the newspaper. He just died. And that was the family's way of telling me not to bother trying anymore. And there are no words to express the kind of pain I felt. You would have thought I knew him my whole life, and I didn't, but I took it real, real hard. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous pointed out to me that I don't make amends for approval. The big book tells me I don't make amends to be forgiven. I make amends to clean up my side of the street. I make amends to stay sober. So all I can tell you is that the actions I took worked, because not once, not even once, was I ever tempted to drink over that rejection. I'm just so sorry he didn't get to know the person I am today, because I know he would have been proud. Could you pour me some water? Excuse me, I have asthma, so I had to do an inhaler before I got up here. Really make my mouth dry, so, well, I just like to drink, really. Anyway, so we're living back in Long Beach, California, across the street from Franklin Junior High. Franklin Junior High is a gang-related school. My daughter's 14 years old, and now she's running with a very dangerous gang. I'm doing awful, humiliating, embarrassing things to my daughter. But I was not only embarrassing my daughter, I was embarrassing this entire gang. We lived in an apartment. I mean, really, gun-toting, knife-wheeling gang. They had a little soft spot for me, I don't know, or for my daughter. But anyway, being evicted from another apartment, lights, gas, telephone, all been turned off for a long time. I'm hiding out from the landlord because he's trying to serve me an eviction notice. So I kept my drapes closed, always closed. And my apartment's dark day and night. It's dark. It's so dark that now I'm seeing evil spirits. And unless you've seen them, they're very hard to describe. But these evil spirits would do things to me like follow me around the house. And I, in turn, would do things like crawl out of the house on my hands and knees, butt naked, across the street to the school ground and warn my daughter and her gang friends not to come home. The house is possessed with evil spirits. And this is the kind of stuff I did that makes me wish to God I was a blackout drinker. But I'm not a blackout drinker. I get to remember. All the neighbors felt sorry for my daughter. They would feed her. They would hide her out from me sometimes. Sometimes they even fed me. Once we were next door at the neighbor's house, she was feeding both of us. And on her counter, she had a bottle of 100-proof vodka. Well, I didn't even know it came in 100-proof. I thought all vodka was 80-proof. But anyway, so I thought that was very intriguing. And something happened outside, like a car accident, and my neighbor and my daughter went to check it out, and I lagged behind because I wanted to drink some of that vodka down real fast and not get caught. I was always promising my daughter I wouldn't drink. And so I grabbed that bottle. I started drinking right out of the bottle. I don't know how much I drank or how fast I drank it, but I do know it was enough to stop my respiratory system. At that point, I stopped breathing, and I could remember the sensation I couldn't breathe. And that's the last thing I remember. I don't remember the paramedics. I don't remember being rushed to the hospital. I don't have any memory of being brought back to life. By the time I had any memory, I woke up, and both my hands were strapped down to a hospital bed, and a nurse had just slapped me in the face because I was screaming obscenities at her because I was a very mean and vile drunk. But this did get my attention. This time I almost died under the influence of alcohol, and it scared me. And I didn't want to die out there. And the reason why I didn't want to die out there is I didn't want to do to my daughter all the things that I didn't want her to have to experience the things that I had to experience. All the police, all the ambulance, all the chaos, all the drama. I just didn't want to do that to her. And so I finally started listening to her because she used to tell me on a daily basis, she would say, "Mom, it's the alcohol. And if you wouldn't drink, you wouldn't do those things." She said, "Just smoke pot." So this is my only experience smoking pot. But I don't have any friends of my own, so I smoked this pot with my daughter and her friends. And afterwards, we're walking down the street, and I have on tight, tight jeans, and I have my hands shoved down in my pockets. And I don't know if I tripped over a crack or my own foot, but I tripped, and I started to go down. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been on pot, but for me, it was different. It was just different. I had the feeling that I was in slow motion. I had the sensation that the sun was coming up at my face. And no matter how hard I tried, and I really tried hard to get my hands out of my pockets, I couldn't get my hands out of my pockets. So you got to picture a grown woman laying with her face smashed in the cement. Her hands are still sticking out of her pockets. And everybody standing around me, they were laughing hysterically. I guess when you smoke pot, you laugh a lot. I don't know. I wasn't laughing, but I was laying there And I could hear all of them laughing. And as I heard that laughter, I had that moment of clarity. I knew right then and there, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that pot was not the answer. And I went right back to my drinking. And I drank for a while longer. And what finally happened for me, it wasn't dying. It wasn't the awful things I put my daughter through. It wasn't that demoralization. Well, it was that demoralization. That's exactly what it was. I reached that point you read about on page 151 in the big book, and it talks about facing those hideous four horsemen. I woke up one more morning on my front room floor. My daughter says I was completely naked and covered with Doritos, because she's always picking the Doritos off of me, and laying in a puddle of fluid. Don't know what the fluid was. But I couldn't do it one more day. You know, I felt those feelings of terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. And I just couldn't do it another day. Couldn't do it another day. And I took the first three steps, and I didn't even know what the first three steps were. But I knew I was powerless over alcohol, and my life had never, ever been manageable. And I already believed that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I just didn't think he would because of what I'd done to the church. And this was my way of turning my will and my life over to the care of God, as I just got on my knees and I said, God, please, I don't care how you do it, but please just get me sober. And I managed to call a prayer line that was affiliated with the church I was in, because in my mind, I thought God wouldn't listen to my prayers because of what I'd done to the church, but maybe God would listen to their prayers. And they prayed for me for 30 days, and within 30 days, I was sober. And it's a series of God coincidences that got me to that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I would not have gone to AA. That's the one thing I would never have done, because my mom was in and out of AA, and she proved to me it didn't work. But I ended up at that first meeting, and I was so physically sick from withdrawals. An old-timer had me stand out in the parking lot. He said, don't go in yet. I'll be right back. He went and he bought me two beers, and he made me drink them, really forced them down my throat, because he knew I wasn't going to make it through the meeting. He knew I was not going to make it through the meeting. And that was on November 10th, 1979, and that's the last drink I ever had, was drinking those two beers. And that meeting was, if it was any other meeting, I don't know if I'd be sober. You know, there was just this girl there that just told my story. She said that she didn't drink till later on in life, that she practiced her disease of alcoholism, compulsive overeating, and amphetamine abuse. But the one thing she said, and this is the reason why I stayed, she said her whole life growing up, some kids wanted to be doctors, some kids wanted to be lawyers, and all she ever wanted to do when she grew up was just not to be an alcoholic like her mom. And I just started to cry. And I just knew I was never going to drink again. I just knew that I had found my place in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why I didn't think about my mom's going in and out, in and out. I just knew I was where I was supposed to be. And I was so sick, I couldn't get to another meeting. Well, I went to a meeting with that girl the next morning. And I was so sick at that meeting, a woman had to take me home. And her story was in the big book. It's called Any Day's a Wash Day, in the third edition. And she had to take me home because I was, I guess you'd call them DTs, going through DTs. And so I was just at home suffering for a week, not going to a meeting, but I was not drinking. I mean, it was, I could not drink if I wanted to. It was so important for me to go back to that meeting for them to see that I was still sober. And, you know, we have a tradition, 10th tradition, we have no opinion on outside issues. And as far as I was concerned, diet pills were an outside issue. And so I continued doing diet pills, you know, and when you're doing some real good speed, you can do a really fast inventory. Whoa, did I get through those steps fast? But what that did for me, doing my inventory, even though I was on speed, it revealed to me that I was not sober unless I gave up abusing that medication. And so I gave that up January 23rd, 1980. And that's when I celebrate my AA birthday, is when I gave up the speed. So I'm 6 months sober. I'm on my ninth step. My sponsor says I have to get a job. I have to be fully self-supporting through my own contributions. I don't know how to work. When out there, I got my first job. That's where I learned how to work. I learned things like how to get there every day, how to get there on time, how to not leave early, how to only take a 30-minute lunch break. I did not know how to do those things. I learned them here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked my first year full-time for my first job full-time for eight years. I stayed on another 2 years part-time after I took another full-time position. So I was there for a total of 10 years. And when I left that job, I had worked myself up to assistant administrator. And in that first eight-year period, wouldn't you know it'd be somebody I sponsor? Okay, Carol, yeah, you got the right sponsor. I told her earlier, if you still want me to sponsor you, you got to be really sick. After this goofy day I've had. Anyway, I went to high school because I could not pass a GED, and I graduated from high school in 1985. I was 36 years old, and I graduated with 450 18-year-olds. It was a cap and a gown, a real ceremony. Thank you. I had so much shame, I didn't tell anybody in AA about it. Nobody in AA came to my graduation, just my sister and my brother. But it was a very shameful thing for me. And my sponsor had died, so she wasn't involved either. So maybe she was there, I don't know. But anyway, so what I did for the next 6 years is I went to work for Musical Theater Corporation. It was equity. Equity means union. And it meant that we dealt with pretty big major stars. Excuse me. I started in the bottom in the accounting department and went back to school and eventually worked myself up to business manager of this multi-million dollar corporation. And as business manager, I dealt with millions of dollars. And this is the honest truth. I didn't know how many zeros were in $1 million when I got to this program. I had not a clue how many zeros were in $1 million. I have participated in union negotiations, and I've been invited into some of the homes of some of the most famous people you see even today on stage, screen, and TV. And even today, I'll see myself in a picture with a very famous person, and I still get that old thought, like, how did I ever get from the gutters of Long Beach to being invited into some of these places? And how that happened is I worked the last part of that 12th step. A lot of people seem to forget that, but we have to apply these principles in all our affairs. I'm going to share one last story with you, and I'm going to close, and it's basically how I came to terms with the God I have in my life today. And I already told you about my daughter being kidnapped and my having to seek God. I just felt betrayed by God, and my daughter felt betrayed by God, and I wanted to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to leave God because of a sentence in the Big Book. I mean, I used to love this page, but this one sentence I just couldn't deal with, it said, it's page 449 in the third edition and 417 in the fourth edition, and it talks about acceptance, and I still like the part on acceptance. But that one sentence says, absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. And so in my disease of perception, I perceived that to mean that that had to be an act of God. It had to be an act of God, and I wanted to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to leave God because I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt I didn't want any part of a God that could operate like that. And thank God for one of the Honeycutt brothers. He just took me by the hand, and he said, Michael, God is good, and good is God, and if it's not good, it's not of God. He said, man has free will. That man was acting on his free will, and your daughter was just a victim. He said, if man didn't have free will, we wouldn't all be sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd all be perfect people. And when he told me that, I had a spiritual release, and I knew he was telling me the truth, and I came to terms with my God again. But I still had so much trouble with that sentence in the Big Book. People would say that sentence when they talk. I just would feel rage, you know, just rage. And because I have the story I have, I sponsor a lot of women who have come from tragic situations. And one of them, her story's too gruesome to even tell you from the podium, but she was telling me that her tragedy must be God's will, because in the big book it says absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. This woman desperately needed comfort, and I went off on her like a crazy woman, and I started screaming at her that that wasn't written by the first 100 alcoholics. It's not in the first 2 editions of this book. I threw the book down and continued to say a few other things, and I noticed she was crying. I made this girl cry. And as I saw her tears, I knew that I have a problem. I have a resentment about something in the big book. And this resentment's not only hurting me, now it's hurting other people. And because it was hurting other people, I prayed daily for God to just help me with that sentence. And I was in a meeting with my sponsor, and she was sharing about a tape by Clancy called Disease of Perception. And in that meeting, when she said the words, disease of perception, I had the biggest spiritual encounter that I ever had. And I couldn't hear another word Polly said, and I couldn't see anything in the room. It was like a white fog or how you'd explain it. But that inner voice said, Michael, you know what happens in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is part of God's world. When you're working those 12 steps is part of God's world. The progression of all good is part of God's world. What happened in that car 9 years ago was part of man's world. And at that point, I was able to separate man's world from God's world, and I was able to come to terms with that sentence in the big book. And I, too, can say absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. It's God's world that got me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. 2 weeks after that experience, I found myself sitting down having dinner with Dr. Paul, who wrote that sentence in the big book. I was at such peace, I did not have to go off on him and and tell him what I thought about him and what I thought about that sentence. And that might not work for you, and that's okay, because I truly believe that God works for each one of us at our own level of understanding. I once heard, if you take one step towards God, God will take 10 steps towards you. And in this lifetime, as we know it, we will never, ever reach God's level of understanding. But once we're on a spiritual path, God does not want to lose one of us. So he comes to each one of us. He works for each one of us at our individual level of understanding. And that's why what works for you might not work for me, and what works for me might not work for you. But the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is whatever you believe, it will work within the 12 steps. Since that day, Dr. Paul is a spiritual advisor. I've talked to lots of conventions with him, and I miss him a lot because he's no longer with us. But I still feel him when I'm telling that story. I feel him to the depth of my soul. And what he told me about that sentence was he did not mean anything like that when he wrote that sentence. He said he was not thinking of man's inhumanity to man. He said my spiritual experience was the best explanation he could think of as to why evil exists in this world. And I'm so thankful I paid attention to something I read in the 12 and 12 under step 10. It said restraint of pen and tongue. Because I cannot tell you how many times I sat down and started to write him, I guess you'd call it a hate letter. You know how spiritual I am, write him a hate letter. And never had to follow through and send that to him, thank God. Because he became an absolute gift in my life, and I think I would have missed out if I would have followed through and sent off that hate letter. But anyway, I really want to thank you for allowing me to be here. And I know today, I call every page in the big book my favorite page. Here's another favorite page of mine. You know, they talk about being rocketed into that fourth dimension of existence. But Bill talks about it on page 8. And on page 8, he says catapulted. But he gives you a description of what that fourth dimension is like. And I can tell you today, with all my aches, all my pains, all my surgeries, my disabled daughter, whatever's going on, I still know those feelings of happiness, peace, and best of all, that feeling of usefulness. Thank you.